Wow, thank you very, very much. I'm sorry there isn't enough room, but I'm delighted so many people came out. This is just fabulous. Just thrilled to be here. I've been on a bit of a tour of Manitoba, going into some of the smaller communities, talking about what matters to people here, the same things that matter to people everywhere. Hog barns, hog barns, hog barns I've heard about. I am very, very grateful, Larissa, thank you, and also to the local chapter here, to the University of Winnipeg Student Association, to CKUW, to my dear friend Rob Altemeyer, and to Loretta Gerlach, who's our prairie organizer for the Council of Canadians, and all of you who've been involved in putting this evening together. I just came back from Johannesburg, South Africa, where they held the World Summit on Sustainable Development. And it was a shameful, shameful thing that happened there. The governments of the world, under the auspices of the UN, were to come together 10 years after they met the first time in Rio for the Earth Summit, and decide on what they were going to do about the environmental disasters that we're all facing. And they met in a place called Sandton, which is a great big... one of the wealthiest suburbs, they say the wealthiest suburb in the so-called third world, made as the financial epicenter for South Africa, which has become the financial epicenter for Africa. You get off the plane in South Africa, the first sign you saw was a great big De Beers ad, but instead of their diamonds are forever, it had a water drop in the shape of a diamond, and water is forever. And the official sponsors were among the official sponsors were Coca-Cola and McDonald's, which has got the UN to help it sponsor Worldwide Children's Day, and for every, I don't know, whatever not the little Mac is, not the Big Mac, whatever the little one is, that's sold around the world, X number of pennies goes to a wash your hands program in the developing world. BMW was there in there. They had their sustainable development villages. They were just kind of bubbles where there was a kind of a trade show. They had a big thing called the Water Dome, which was a trade show on water, held in the old casino with huge rooms, just a huge venue. And they had great big blue kind of streamers coming from the top of this huge dome, and they had a synchronized computer light and sound system the whole time that made you look as if you were underwater. They had a huge stage set up, and they had people on the stage. One was an act where these young women were the Nile River. it was really quite unbelievably awful. I don't know if you read about this, but God was really upset about this meeting in South Africa, and she decided that she was going to just have it out and really end things. So she decided to call three world leaders together last week. You might have missed this in the media, but she called George Bush of the United States, and she called Jiang Zemin of China, and she called, that guy, Jean Chrétien from Canada. And she sat them down and she said, I gave you a beautiful blue and green planet and you're destroying it, and you came here all the way from all over. Trade show. They had a big thing called the Water Dome, which was a trade show on water, held in the old casino with huge rooms, just a huge venue. And they had great big blue kind of streamers coming from the top of this huge dome, and they had a synchronized computer light and sound system the whole time that made you look as if you were underwater. They had a huge stage set up, and they had people on the stage. One was an act where these young women were the Nile River. it was really quite unbelievably awful. I don't know if you read about this, but God was really upset about this meeting in South Africa, and she decided that she was going to just have it out and really end things. So she decided to call three world leaders together last week. You might have missed this in the media, but she called George Bush of the United States, and she called Jiang Zemin of China, and she said, that guy, Jean Chrétien from Canada. And she sat them down and she said, I gave you a beautiful blue and green planet and you're destroying it, and you came here all the way from all over the world to the WSSD and you didn't do anything but spend money on your big corporations, and I've had it, and I'm not waiting for the world to end a little bit at a time. I'm finishing it off in 3 days. So you have it here, told to you now by me, go home, tell your people and get ready. So George Bush went home and he went on national television and he said, I have good news and I have bad news. The good news is there's a God. The bad news is she's a woman and she's really temperamental, like all women, except my saintly mother, and she's going to destroy the world in 3 days. That's the bad news. Zhang Zemin went home and he went on national television and he said, I have bad news and I have worse news. The bad news is there's a God. The worst news is our dream of competing with the United States for world economic domination isn't going to happen. Jean Chrétien came home and he went on national television. He said, I have great news and I have greater news. The great news is I'm a world leader. And the greater news is Paul Martin will never become prime minister. Very good. Roll you back. I want to talk about this thing called the commons, because, you know, I go all over the world, and I know a lot of people in this room also do some international travel, and I go all over this wonderful country, and I see people fighting on the ground against losing their health care, or against a private water taking, or against Coca-Cola coming in as a corporate sponsor in their schools, or whatever. And we're doing wonderful work on the ground, but I think there needs to be an emerging kind of analysis about what is it that we're collectively fighting for. We're pretty sure what we're against, but what is it we're fighting for? And there's been a number of us talking recently about putting some real flesh around an analysis around this notion of the commons. What is it in common that we're fighting for when you're fighting for clean water or healthcare or education or the right to air or the right to food or whatever, those areas that we, you know, we're starting to see as kind of one continuum. Maybe it's very different in different parts of the world, but I'm finding that we have so much in common in our struggles around the world. So I just want to roll back for a few minutes, particularly for anybody kind of new to this, and just remind us what it is that we're up against. And then we're doing wonderful work on the ground, but I think there needs to be an emerging kind of analysis about what is it that we're collectively fighting for. We're pretty sure what we're against, but what is it we're fighting for? And there's been a number of us talking recently about putting some real flesh around an analysis around this notion of the commons. What is it in common that we're fighting for when you're fighting for clean water or healthcare or education or the right to air or the right to food or whatever, those areas that we, you know, we're starting to see as kind of one continuum. Maybe it's very different in different parts of the world, but I'm finding that we have so much in common in our struggles around the world. So I just want to roll back for a few minutes, particularly for anybody kind of new to this, and just remind us what it is that we're up against. And then I want to talk about this concept of the commons, because I think it's very exciting. But I want to roll back to a time when a number of us, myself included, were fighting for issues like human rights or women's rights or whatever, anti-poverty issues, fighting for increased social programs and stuff. And we saw ourselves in a kind of continuum, a train moving forward, and we didn't imagine that this train could be derailed. And a lot of us, while we started to see social conservatism come at us and we were dealing with that, and a lot of us didn't in those days see neoliberalism, which is not necessarily social conservatism, coming down the pike and what it would do. I want to remind you or tell you about a study that was published by the Trilateral Commission, which was a group of corporate and governmental forces who came together in the mid-1970s to, in their terms, deal with the excess of democracy that had been blossoming in countries like Canada and Europe. One published report for the Trinational Commission openly pined, and I'm not kidding you, for the days when the U.S. president had been able to govern the country, and I quote, with the cooperation of a relatively small number of Wall Street lawyers and bankers, and they lamented the public's questioning of the legitimacy of hierarchy, coercion, discipline, secrecy, and deception, all, and I quote again, inescapable attributes of the process of government. The paper went on to say that a governable democracy requires apathy and non-involvement, especially on the part of marginalized groups, which the commission cited as blacks, Indians, white ethnic groups, students, and women. About 85% of the population by my count, right? So what came out of this process was what's now called the Washington Consensus, and that's an elite consensus that there's really only one economic model for the world, including the developing world, and that's a market-based economy with a greatly reduced role for the state. Margaret Thatcher used to say the state or the, she used to call it the Tina syndrome. There is no alternative. And with the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of history was announced. You know, it was over. Communism had failed for all time. Capitalism had trumped. The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund were given the mandate to propose and impose structural adjustment programs on developing countries and to say, if you want debt relief or you want further money for your development programs, you have to cut back on health and education, and you have to shift from subsistence or sustainable agriculture to monoculture export crops, the crops that we want. You have to let transnational corporations come in and replace your domestic companies and so on. And now every major institution in the world has bought into this. The World Bank, the World Trade Organization, which was created in 1995, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which is now morphing into the free trade area of the Americas. I hate to tell you, but the United Nations is truly buying into this agenda. Kofi Annan, the General Secretary of the United Nations, has been quoted fairly often as saying, now the United Nations is becoming a player again because they've got this global compact with a number of corporations, including such companies as Shell and Nike. So now suddenly the UN's a player because it's buying into what this they're now calling convergence. That's what happened at the WSSD. There was a document going into that venue and into that event that basically said, yes, we'll deal with environment, yes, we'll deal with poverty, yes, we'll deal with development, but it must converge through the prism of the text, the ministerial text that came out of Doha, Qatar, which had met earlier in the Emirates, the dictatorship of Qatar. And you'll remember, many of us were in Seattle 2 years and a bit ago when we shut down the World Trade Organization. Well, this time they moved it to a place where there is no legal dissent whatsoever. There's no right to vote. There's no right to free speech. About 75 of us activists from the entire world were allowed to go. There were 11,000 heavily armed security guards in case we got out of hand. We are extremely dangerous people. But they didn't finish their agenda there, and it was a really distressing kind of thing to watch in Doha because 9/11 had just happened, and the United States was there acting like the new Rome. I mean, they even had a Praetorian guard around the trade representative, Robert Zoellick, when he moved through the compound. They would have a spear, like a kind of a Marines, U.S. Marines in front of him, and then the Iraqi, Qatari security surrounding him, and then he would be in this kind of enclave in the middle of it, and they would just storm through this five-star hotel compound that we were all put on. It was really an amazing thing. And what the United States said to the developing countries, what I call the two-thirds world, is, I don't care if you don't like what's happening here. We don't care if you don't think this agenda is good for you. We will consider you with us or against us on terrorism by whether you're with us or against us on this deal. And I saw some of the rawest, ugliest politics I've ever seen. Well, they just moved their meeting, which ended finally a day late because everybody was exhausted and planes were going home and Ramadan was starting, but they didn't get it quite finished, so they moved it to Johannesburg. And I met with the leaders of the Canadian delegation, the official delegation in Canada, from Canada, and the head of it's from the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade. There wasn't even an attempt to pretend that this was about the environment. So we started calling it, instead of Doha or Rio plus 10, we started calling it Doha plus 10 because, you know, it was 10 months later after Doha, and they just moved the entire agenda to Johannesburg. So this is now the agenda bought into by our government, many provincial governments, as you well know, obviously Europe, Japan, what they called in Johannesburg, Juscan. So it's Japan, US, EU, Canada, United States, New Zealand, and Australia, and those are the power blocks that are moving this agenda forward. And it feels very, very powerful when you go to somewhere like Johannesburg and you see absolutely not only no progress, but they actually moved the agenda back, in my opinion, many, many years. And the only tangible thing that came out of it was a sanitation project with objectives that included aid targets that enforces corporations to deliver these services in developing countries. It was a a particularly awful thing to watch in terms of how cynical it was, how open it was, how corporate it was, and how unsettled the whole process was. So economic globalization and the terms of this new world has several characteristics. The first is the growth of transnational corporations operating outside of any domestic law or any international rules except these international free trade agreements. Of the 100 largest economies in the world, 53 are now transnational corporations. Mitsubishi is the 22nd largest economy in the world. General Motors is 26th and Ford is 31st. Walmart is bigger than 163 countries. So when Walmart comes into a country and says, please look the other way if I break your labor laws, all sorts of countries, including so-called first world countries, look the other way. The combined sales of the largest 200 global corporations last year exceeded the combined GDP of 182 countries and amounted to almost twice the annual income of the bottom four-fifths of humanity, which I think is an absolute obscenity. There's also a creation in this brave new world of an entrenched underclass in every society, and this is one of the things that I take to my travels in the developing world, and that is that there's a first world in your country, and there's a third world in my country. I just got back from Japan not long ago, and there's a third world in Japan. The joke out there, which isn't very funny, is what's the difference between Argentina and Japan? The answer is 5 years. Japan appears to be a very wealthy country, but there are now thousands and thousands of men sleeping on the streets, sleeping in the park, sleeping in the subways, in their suits, and thousands every year put themselves under the railway, the passing trains, and the big debate in Japan is whether to stop the trains to deal with this, to deal with the mass, or let them keep on running because they pride themselves in the fact that the trains run to the nanosecond. Even the World Bank, is now saying that the top 1% of the world's population now earns as much as the poorest 57%. That is that the 50 million richest people in the world earn as much as the poorest 2.7 billion. And even the World Bank admitted this is a staggering increase in inequality in the last decade. They can't understand why, mind you, but they are finally admitting that somehow something is terribly wrong with their policies. And it's, of course, not just in those countries. Other countries, Canada, has experienced the highest rate rise in child poverty in the industrialized world, 60% and counting in a decade. And in the United States, the average CEO has seen a 535% increase in executive compensation in the last decade. For those in financial services, CEO compensation rose by 12,444% in those years. And this is irrespective of whether those corporations did well or not, irrespective of how they were as managers. That's the money they're earning. We're also spreading a global monoculture around the world. My favorite story around this is a survey that was taken of 5,700 young people in Asia Pacific. And one of the questions for them was to name their favorite food and drink. And their answers were Australia, McDonald's and Coca-Cola, China, McDonald's and Coca-Cola, Hong Kong, McDonald's and Coca-Cola, Indonesia, McDonald's and Coca-Cola, Japan, McDonald's and Coca-Cola, Malaysia, McDonald's and Coca-Cola, Singapore, McDonald's and Coca-Cola, Taiwan, McDonald's and Coca-Cola. Thailand, you'll be happy to hear, said KFC and Pepsi, so there's hope for our world. And I guess the final characterization of this elite consensus known as the Washington Consensus is the privatization of absolutely everything, the modern enclosure of the commons, those areas of life that we used to consider common property or common human rights or natural resources that belong to all. All of these are now fair game for corporations, for trade agreements, for the World Bank. These were all activities that in the past were off limits to economic globalizations. Trade agreements used to recognize a demarcation between goods and services, public and private, and the right of countries to have laws. That's all gone. They're now negotiating what they call non-tariff barriers, which are the rules, regulations, public standards and so on, social programs that we believe that we have the right to have as citizens of a nation and of a world, but all this has changed. Trade agreements enforced by the World Trade Organization are now out to privatize such natural services and public services as water, healthcare, education, and to take down all of these non-tariff barriers to trade. They have something that they call government measures, and they basically want to be able to, for the World Trade Organization to actually decide whether measures and regulations that governments have fit a criteria of being what they call least trade restrictive. What this means is that everything is now for sale. The rain before it falls, the fish before it's caught, the seed deep in the forest, and the very building blocks of life. Now, I want to talk about this commons because this is what I think this is what binds what we're trying to fight for here. And if we can have a notion of fighting for something instead of against something, I believe it would be very helpful to our movement at this time. The commons has been called by author Jonathan Rowe of the Tamales Bay Institute in California. He's a realm that lies outside both the economic market and the institutionalized state, although, of course, government plays a crucial role in protecting the commons. The commons is the collective heritage of humanity, and it is used without toil or price. It's the atmosphere and oceans, languages and cultures, the store of human knowledge and wisdom, the informal support systems of communities, the peace and quiet we crave, the genetic building blocks of life. All of these form part of what we're calling the commons. Some are gifts of nature, like water, and others are the collective productivity or the product of human creativity and endeavor. Some are new, like the internet or healthcare, or our Medicare system in any case. These are the modern commons, and some are more like the ancient commons, such as folklore, myths, and cooking. But what they have in common, what they share, is that they belong to us all. No one has the exclusive right to them, and we inherit the commons jointly, and they are more basic to our lives than either the market or the government. The value of the commons is beyond reckoning, but because there's so little acknowledgement of it legally or politically or in any form, in our culture, and no legal framework to protect it, the commons has become subject to constant invasion, theft, and abuse. In the name of economic growth, and remember, all of this is positively reflected in a country's GDP. You can have an earthquake, you can have terrible fire, you can have high death rates. It's all positively reflected in a GDP because it just reflects what you've spent. The global commons is being plundered. Economic growth has become a process of the cannibalization of the commons, whereby a good is taken from the commons, diminished and degraded, then technologically enhanced and sold back to us in its commodified form. I'll give you three quick examples. The first is genetics. The advent of genetic engineering is very real and forms perhaps the most obvious and relentless assault on our commons. As the vast biological commons includes forests, fish, plants, seeds, animals, and humans, it is being transformed into patentable commodities at a ferocious rate. Genetic engineering of our food, for example, arrived almost totally unannounced on our tables overnight. 10 years ago, no genetically engineered food was sold in Canadian stores. Today, 3/4 of all our prepared food that we buy contains some amount of genetically engineered products. Thousands of genetic patents have been taken by corporations, resulting in the wholesale plunder of the genetic inheritance of the third world by the business and corporate interests and government interests of the North. Give you a very close to home example, however, is a case of Myriad Genetics, which is an American biotech firm that has taken out a series of patents that gives it extensive control over the gene that has been isolated that is now believed to cause or be linked to breast cancer. Myriad, this company, has claimed a 20-year patent monopoly on the gene and all methods to develop to diagnose and treat hereditary breast and ovarian cancer. So a number of provincial and state governments across North America and in Europe, and including a number of universities that have public programs, public research programs, have suspended their breast cancer research because they're being told by Myriad that they have to pay a royalty right, a very expensive royalty right, in order for them to be able to use this test. And of course, they fear a trade-related challenge if they continue the research without paying up. Now, we could be talking about women actually dying because this has stopped the process of this kind of research. A recent study showed that 50% of laboratory physicians have abandoned disease testing because of patents granted to corporations. The huge pharmaceutical, agri-food, and biotech corporations have moved into universities, driving research and the direction of private property. So that's one example. A second example, very, very dear to my heart, is the issue of fresh water. The world is running out of fresh water. Next time you go and walk in the rain, just remember that not only is this finite amount of water in the world the same amount that was here at the creation of the planet, it's the same water. You know, when it rains, you just remember that some of that rain was in the blood of dinosaurs or in the tears of children who lived in the back of history. It's the same water. We have one hydrologic cycle. And yet we are polluting, depleting, and diverting it so quickly that by the most conservative counts, by the year 2025, 2/3 of the world's population will be living without adequate access to fresh water. 1/3 will be living in total and absolute water deprivation. Now, I mean, I could not exaggerate it. A child dies every 8 seconds as we speak of waterborne disease in our world. But faced with this, and now we're taking the underground water, the aquifer water, ancient aquifer water, and using it to build on deserts and to have our Las Vegases and to build food where it shouldn't be built and to have the kind of a first world lifestyle that we have chosen to have. We are now diverting, depleting, and polluting the underground water sources at a rate far, far faster than nature can replenish them. Now suddenly, and this has been sudden that we know this, it's been like a study here and a study there, and it's suddenly in the last decade been pulled together, and scientists are saying, my God, look at this, it's like a comet coming at us. This is a life and death issue. I believe personally that it's the most important environmental issue ever. Is the coming freshwater shortage, the already here freshwater shortage in many, many parts of the world. But faced with this well-documented crisis, however, governments are straight up against this Washington consensus model, and they believe that they have to cut back on their responsibility and privatize testing and hand over the control of these water resources to transnational corporations. The consensus that they have is that privatization and the commodification of water is the future. Price it, they say in chorus, put it up for sale and let the market determine its future. For them, the debate is closed. They say that water is a human need, not a human right. And that's not a semantic, because you can't buy or trade or sell a human right. But you can do that if you just produce it as describe it as a need to be fulfilled by a corporate, as a corporate commodity. So a handful of transnational corporations, backed by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, are now aggressively taking over the management of the Earth's freshwater resources. They're telling countries around the world, particularly in the third world, you must accept our corporations, privatize your water systems, and we will meter. And I'll tell you a little bit about that metering in South Africa in a few minutes. But all over the world, the whole notion of full cost pricing is suddenly upon people. If they can't pay for water, they don't have water. And it also comes in the form of bottled water. We're putting something like, last year we put something like 100 billion liters of water in bottles like this around the world. And it's now something like a $75 billion industry, but growing exponentially, about 20% a year. Well, it's a form of mass insanity to allow our public water systems to degrade while we put water in bottles that are obviously polluting our waterways and so on. This is absolutely the wrong model. The answers for water are very, very simply the twin foundations of conservation on one hand and equity on the other. But the Washington consensus dictates hand it over to the private sector. The third example is healthcare, ripe for the picking. World Bank now estimates that if it was all privatized, last year's healthcare industry in the world would have added up to about $5 trillion. The transnational corporations in the health industry are chomping at the bit to get at public services like Canada's public services. In fact, there's an American public relations firm that calls Canada's public health care system the last unopened oyster in North America. And they're counting on the General Agreement on Trade and Services, which is the services agreement of the WTO now underway, to pry open health care. Past commitments to universal health care for all citizens of the world have been abandoned. The World Bank and the IMF have forced many third world countries to privatize health care and to let health transnationals into their countries. Starting with Margaret Thatcher, many northern countries have also abandoned their public health care systems, which are increasingly being driven by private companies. And you know the story in the United States. It's run as a big business. There have been vertical and horizontal corporate mergers, and they've created huge transnational healthcare corporations whose profits now dominate the Fortune 500. Thousands and thousands of nurses have been laid off, while healthcare corporations skim huge salaries off the back of the sick. An average of $10 million U.S. is the average income for the top 25 CEOs of these health corporations in the United States. And the annual profit stands now in the U.S. alone at about $1 trillion. As a result, around 45 million Americans are completely uninsured for health care, and 264 million Americans die every single day because they have no health insurance. Another 30 to 50 million have substandard care, and over 200 million do not have comprehensive care, such as long-term coverage, and it's usually very connected to their employment in any case. Now, where it still exists, like Canada, healthcare is being put into agreements like the GATS, the General Agreement on Trade and Services, or now there's a new services agreement of the Free Trade Area of the Americas, which is, in my opinion, why they're extending NAFTA to the other countries of the Americas. It's not because of that. They have free trade agreements with most of those countries. I think it's because they want to open NAFTA and put healthcare and other services in NAFTA. Because don't forget, in NAFTA is this Chapter 11, which allows corporations to sue for lost profit if you change your mind and bring in any kind of regulation once they've established themselves. So imagine flirting with private healthcare, allowing or not being able to stop American HMOs coming to Canada or health corporations coming to Canada, not being happy with it, electing a different government that promises to bring back our public healthcare system and being told you can't do it because you owe billions of dollars of compensation to these healthcare corporations who came in under other circumstances. And that's how NAFTA is currently worded. So it's not even a future trade agreement that we're dealing with. So these commons, this commons language, and I'm going to shut up pretty soon because we've got lots of people in here with lots of good ideas, and I'd rather talk with you than at you. But I think we need to start talking about these as issues that have a commonality, of the commons, so that we can start to build an analysis and language around it that helps us move forward. And I actually now and then give speeches to business types, and I put to them this notion that there should be some areas that are off limit to what they do. And I say to them, and it's true, I'm not opposed to trade. It's as ancient as humanity. I'm not even opposed to trade rules if we have fair trade rules, which we do not at the moment. But there should be some areas that are carved out of the marketplace system that are just off limits. Education should be off limits. Corporate logos should be out of our schools. One American educator calls it survival of the children of the fittest, the system that we're now developing in allowing public schools to deteriorate to the point where people are saying, I'll take my public money or my taxpayer money and put it into something private so I can at least take care of my own child. We have to find and develop a new kind of language around what these rights are, and I believe that we would have a very good case to take to our governments, to each other, to organizations that are doing this kind of work if we were to use this kind of language. But we're going to have to do it together with people who are fighting these issues in the places in the world where it's most hard to fight. I want to end this part of the talk, and I want to leave lots of time to have a discussion with you, telling you about going into one of the poorest townships in South Africa and bringing a group of people to see this on a bus. And watching how we're talking about the poorest places, some of the poorest places on earth. I mean, burning tires and miles and kilometers of burning garbage and burning grass and huts and that are just basically corrugated iron or tar paper shacks, pit latrines, rats in the alleys, children with no shoes, beautiful, sweet kids though with great hope, but really terrible poverty, who've had the water brought up to their house, but then, and then there's a little water tap. It's not like the water comes in their house and they get to flush a toilet, but at least there's a tap finally outside their house. But between the water pipe and the tap is a meter put in by Suez Lyonnaise des Eaux, which is a big transnational water company. And they give them a state-of-the-art, like this is, these are communities with nothing, but they're given a state-of-the-art electronic key, and when they pay for a certain amount of water, they get the charge to the electronic key, they touch it to the meter, and the meter starts to run. And when they've run out, that's it. They go, in where I was, in Alexandra, they go to a little river nearby for their drinking water, for washing, for everything that has cholera warning signs upon it. And I told some of my friends at dinner, and I'll tell you this lovely fight back that happened. A number of us got off this bus in this one particular community called Orange Farm, where they were just putting these meters in. And what do we spy? But a great big double-decker BMW, gorgeous, brand new, air-conditioned bus filled with a bunch of suits. And they're out, all standing out, smiling at these water meters. And it turns out it's the president, Mestrier, of Suez, the company that put them in, and all his executives and a bunch of people, delegates from the European Union. And they turn around and they smile at us, another bus of tourists, and they realize that the 75 anti-privatization activists have just got off the bus. And they ran. I don't know any other word to use but to say they ran. They surrounded the president and they ran like this. And we followed them quite quickly. We had a couple of cameras with us. And it's a wonderful woman named Virginia Setchetti. Anybody who is at the G8 concert that we had in Calgary will remember Virginia. She spoke there. But they got on the bus and wouldn't answer questions. So Virginia walked up onto this bus, like inside the bus, and she stood there at the front, and she just kind of gave an Old Testament. They got their lecture. She preached to them about what they were doing. Meanwhile, I was standing outside yelling things like, "There's evil in the world, and it's on that bus." So anyway, we kind of lost our cool. But when I tell you, I came away from that just feeling so filled with hope, because I was walking through these communities and I talked to little kids, and I said to one bunch of little kids, I said, "Now, what do you think about these water meters? They're wrong." And I said, "Well, where does the rain come from?" Well, it was one little group. The one said it came from God, and another said, "No, it came from the rain," and another said it was his father that brought it there. But what they all agreed on was that it was wrong to charge money. And the analysis of the children in these communities was as sophisticated as anything that I have, and actually anybody I know has. And that is the hope, is that we are building this international movement community to community. We walked in solidarity in a march because they had put anti-privatization forum people, this is the group, in jail. They had tear gassed them in jail. They wanted all quiet on the South African front for the WSSD. So a group of us held a march, and we marched arm in arm. I marched from one side of me was Oscar Oliveira, who's the leader of the fight against water privatization in Bolivia. And Oscar's not very tall, maybe 5 feet, and quite a humble, quiet man. And on my right was Vandana Shiva, and there was like an international group that went in front with our media there. And they threw stun grenades into the group, and you know, a lot of us kind of stopped, and Oscar just said in Spanish, "Move," like we move, we keep going, we move ahead. And we moved up to the front of the line and spoke, sort of bore witness, if you will, for the international public and the international press that what was happening there was a new form of apartheid. It's called economic apartheid. It's economic corporate globalization apartheid, and it's every bit as real for the people living in South Africa and around the world as the original apartheid. And so it's finding each other across borders, across sectors, across age groups, to say we have an alternative. We know what we're about. We know that we have. We know that a better world's possible. We know what we're building. And I want to tell you that I know sometimes it feels like, and I say this just as much to myself as I'm saying it to all of you, sometimes it feels like giving up. You know, it's just too hard. You know, you've got that boulder and you're pushing it up that hill and it's getting steeper and steeper and the boulder's getting heavier and heavier. But that's often the way it is, just before you hit the top and it levels out and you're just about to win or you're just about to change public opinion in a massive way. I have real hopes for the healthcare fight in this country. I think we may win that one. I really do. I feel very, very positive. I don't think we can let up one little bit. We have our alternatives. It's a primary-based, community-based health system with full pharmacare, with full long-term care, with full home care, getting those pharmaceutical giants into line, getting rid of those patents. Like, we know what we need to build an alternative and better health system than the one we have, and we've got to be aggressive about it. We know how to save the world's water. We know what we need to do. But it's never going to happen if a handful of water corporations is allowed to come in and cartelize the world's water the way they've done with oil and then tell us that that's who has the power and nobody else has any right. It can't happen. We're on the cusp of that fight, and we can stop it. We can stop these hog barns. They are their own indictment. They are in human places with inhuman things happening in them. They are bad for the workers. They are hideous towards the animals. They are bad for the water. They are bad for the air. They are the wrong model. And we can say so, and we can claim the commons back from that kind of inhuman industry. We can say we will bring back to our rural communities a different way of life. We can model what we need to live. And I guess I'd say, of course, it's going to take the rest of the world, our lives, just for us to begin to do this. But then, what else have we got to do? Thank you.